Today's conversation brings together science, rescue, and systems because drowning is not random. It is predictable and it's preventable. But as our environment changes and water risks evolve, the question becomes, are we keeping up? We're joined by two global leaders working at the intersection of physiology, survival, and emergency response. Dr. Patty Morgan is a leading expert in drowning, cold water immersion, and rescue medicine, a consultant in anesthesiologist and trauma team leader based in Bristol, UK. He also serves as a pre-hospital critical care doctor with Great Western Air Ambulance. I think I got that right. Bringing frontline medical experience into the realities of water survival. And Adrian Mayhew is a leader in water safety, flood response, and emergency management. With over 25 years in the UK Fire and Rescue Service, he now serves as Director of National Operations for Surf Life Great Britain, focused on strengthening systems and coordination response. Thank you both for joining us today. It's evening for you both in Europe, and I know that I have tried to track down Dr. Morgan for months, and I finally did. And he's on a ski vacation in the Swiss Alps, and everybody's eating dinner, and he's doing this. That just tells you how important this information and what they do is to getting the message out. And I really appreciate it. And Adrian Mayhew has been on the show before in the summer. It was great. Between he and Dr. Tipton, they've made a big difference here in understanding that float to live is a big issue. Everything about rescue and flood and the myth of dry drowning has made a big impression. And I'm so glad to have you both on. And if we had had Mike Tipton, who said he was on a train from Manchester, going back to Cornwall, he would have joined us. And he sent me, before we start, a paper from the summit, because he told me there's a difference between a conference and a summit. Climate change, healthy aging, and the health crisis, is wisdom the link? I thought that was very interesting, and I'm sure you can. But if I had all three, as I said, it would be the trifecta of water safety.
Oh, bless you. Thank you.
So
Right. Thank you.
let's start out with kind of the big picture. How do you both define the water safety challenge today, and where are we still getting it wrong? What are the biggest misconceptions people have about drowning in water, whether it's the ocean, rivers, or floods? And what happens to the body in the first critical moments of drowning and cold water exposure, and how does that shape survival? So that's a bunch of things, but why don't we start with Dr. Morgan since he hasn't been on first?
Get him in.
Thank you, Mark, for having us on. It's so the first thing to kind of realize is that in drowning prevention, water safety, we're always aiming for excellence. We don't get it right in any area at all, and I can say that with confidence. But what we are doing is we will never achieve perfection because we're working with people, and people make errors, they make mistakes, not intentionally, not with any nefarious requirements. But just because we're humans, we're inquisitive. We were brought up and live near the water. We need it for survival. But in that excellence, what we're doing is, as research from every area of that continuum, we're looking at where have errors been made and how can we make it better next time. So there's always going to be learning. This is not a one-stop shop. There is not a destination. It's a journey, and it's a journey that will carry on long after I'm buried under the ground or ashes. But coming back to your core question, what is water safety? Water safety is recognizing from the point of an accident to the point of either death or being discharged home from hospital, that's a continuum for the individual. For that person, that's the worst day of their life. And it's not just one focused element, it's an entire journey. And so if you then go and look at that and you break it down to the individual sections, then yes. In my role as a pre-hospital critical care doctor with Great Western Air Ambulance or with the Wales Air Ambulance, I need to do the best rescue resuscitation. When I deliver those patients to our hospitals, they need the best rescue resuscitation intensive care. Well, bring it back a stage. They need the best rescue in the first place. Now, of course, rescue, you'd say, well, if we don't get into trouble in the first place, we don't need rescue. So what's the best prevention? And when you look at prevention, prevention is everything from ensuring that those areas that are particularly dangerous geographically, we are signposted against, or advice is given to communities. But it's also a cultural problem. You look at some cultures, the US is quite unique in terms of its population demographics, that there are classically, I remember reading, hearing at a conference 10 years ago now, and it still hasn't changed. There is the white middle class male who learned to swim because his parents taught him to swim, feel that they're safe. And they have accidents when they're now in their 50s and 60s in leisure type activities because they still have the bravado of the 18-year-old college grad who could swim 50 meters in lightning seconds, but has never swum in the sea, has never owned a boat before. You have the other end of the spectrum where you have some of the populations who were water and water safety, learning to swim, learning to float, most importantly, as Professor Tipton's papers point out, is not part of their cultural history. If your grandmother didn't do it, your mum never did it, you never did it. So the first time you're exposed to water is when suddenly you have access or you have money such that you're doing this as a leisure activity. Or in those worst case scenarios, you're now blending those cultural backgrounds. And you have children from different backgrounds, different ethnicities playing together. Some have that water safety awareness and natural avoidance in the same way they don't put their hands in a fire. Some, they don't have that. So it's not normal for them. It's not ingrained in what they do as a culture. Now, obviously, you're fortunate. Hawaii, beautiful place. I've never been, but everybody who has said it's utterly gorgeous. But you're surrounded by water, but you have a mix of cultures. And for some, water is inherent to what they do. They're living, their livelihood is based around the water, whether it's the sea or the fresh water. And for others, they're, as my family delightfully call us, I'm of Irish heritage, so we're the imports. I suspect in Hawaii you're similar. You have
Yes.
what was imports, people that come to the area because it is a beautiful place to live and bring up your children. And the question is whether you bring with you your cultural background, your cultural experience of learning how to float, your water awareness and safety, or whether you adopt that around you. And sometimes adoption of culture, sometimes that has to be pushed as well as pulled. And that's where I know Hawaii's been quite proactive in terms of putting forward water safety kind of legislation, if you like, or guidelines. You're obviously more au fait than I am. Around how do we generate culture? How do we encourage positive culture around water safety? And if we hit everybody at those different points along that casualties journey from prevent the accident, and if it happens, know what to do as a self-survival. If you know what to do as a self-survival, how do you help others? So again, back to some of the old phrases, float, survive, rescue. Learn how to float, learn how to swim, and survive yourself, learn how to then rescue others. And that's something that we see with Surf Life Saving Great Britain, where I help Aidy out in some of the medical side around that whole, if it's part of your culture, if you'd learn how to float, you learn how to swim, you learn how to navigate those different bodies of water, then you're more likely to survive. But you're also more likely to prevent an accident because you say, well, hey, you're my best friend. No offense, I can swim and I'm not going out in 6 foot dumping surf. So I'm not letting you, and you'd be stupid to do so. So let's go and do something else. But that comes again from that positive culture, sharing of ideas. Start with the children. There's the old phrase in certain charities, I can feed you a fish and that makes you fed for a day. If I teach you to fish, I feed you for life. Teach them to fish, teach them to stay safe. And then down the chain, just keep going, keep putting the data in, and we'll do the rescue and the resuscitation later. But that's the key for me. I'll stop talking now. I'll let
That,
AD
no,
off.
that's great. Now, Adrian, why don't you add on to what you're doing with Surf Life Saving in Great
Yeah,
Britain?
we're seeing a very big picture. So we're trying to do that. Surf Life Saving and any life saving community is a community in its own essence. The clubs have come up and brought into their community, and we see that becoming very established. And it's interesting listening to Paddy's comments because the hard part is we actually get heat maps of where people travel to a coast. so central England, are all our problems because they don't know what, even an island like us ourselves, they don't know the ocean. It's not part of their community. It will start to be in the education program in September 2026 for the new term, for young children to start that legacy of drowning prevention education. So
Can I
float to
stop you
liquid and all
there?
those. It's
What?
taken all these years, decades of shouting and screaming, but it will now go in as part of a culture of not just swimming, but understanding the seasonal risks around that. So hopefully we'll start to see a legacy. So I
Let me
think that
stop
it's
you.
been
Let me
go on.
stop you just for a minute. Where is this going? Is this in the schools you're talking about?
Yeah, it is. It's in the schools.
And
It'll be
you need
going
to
in
say
that school
that very
program.
clearly here, because I know that Dr. Morgan just said, I know we have legislation, but we had legislation that stalled because all it was a simple piece of legislation that said, get water safety education
Got to be
back
done.
in the schools.
Got to be done without hesitation. If you look at how UK fire deaths were reduced by 50% in 10 years, it was legislation on a number of levels: legislation on the manufacturers to build things safely, legislation on builders to build buildings safely, and then build legislation for people to be working safely. And then from that, the fire service could do the things that they easily do, like do an inspection around a building, go to houses and put smoke alarms and deal with the vulnerable. That's how you can do it. If you take those elements and just change from fire to water, the very thing we can do is going have a water safety message that entitles that if we're on a beach, we expect discipline and a legislation around that. If we're at a water site like we see in Australia with a swimming pool, it's fenced off. So there's legislation around that. There's education program, and that education program goes in right down from the 6 and 7 year olds all the way up. So not only they can swim, they can float to live, and they understand the seasonal risks. So it we you know, if you take those elements and learn from fire and put that into the methodology of in water, we start to see that legacy in 10 years' time, where we're starting to see the benefits. And right now, I call it blue therapy. Everybody wants to go to the water. Since we had the massive global pandemic, people now realize it's blue therapies out there from fun, leisure, recreation, sport. It's all gone, bloomed out. But there comes the inherent risk, and that risk not just comes from the community there that want to embrace, but we're now seeing the community there embracing the safety culture because people from outside those coastal areas, people are coming. And
Right.
what does that evidence look like in the UK? We've had a 38% increase in interventions this year.
Wow.
38%. So 4,895 people have been pulled from the water last year. And that's up from 3,500.
Well, I just got a list of interventions like you're talking about for just Kauai, 5,000 in 1 year.
It's unbelievable.
And we only have a population of 75,000 people. And on the North Shore where I am, there was quite a few. So what you've both said about we're dealing with people, and people, they're curious, they want to do different things, and we're not perfect. And I'm sorry I didn't think about this when testimony was needed to submit, because I figured this would go further. But both of you testaments would have made a big difference, I think, here in Kauai, with your international experience.
We can't stop drowning, as Paddy said, but we can stop accidental drowning. We can reduce that to a very low figure, and that's what we should be aiming for. Let's get the things that we can get right and look at those, and then worry about the other things we can't. We can't have a pen and mark everybody or whitewash every single problem. We have to look at the drowning data and then go, where are the bits? Where's the low hanging fruit? And from that low hanging fruit, what do we understand about those areas and how can we can prevent? And then build that and share that knowledge as well. So that's what we've been doing in the UK under the National Water Safety Forum.
So we'll get back to Dr. Morgan, but you said something about heat maps. What do you mean
Yeah,
by
so
heat
heat
maps?
maps are tracking people from where they get, when they get intervention, and what they've done under the National Water Safety Forum and ourselves and the RNI and the Coast Guard is we can actually, when people have been pulled from the water, we ask where they live and we put that data in and we have this heat map of where those people are traveling from and to. So we can tell you, and also at the same time, we can tell you where our drowning problems are. So down in the southwest, always a big problem. In the southeast as well is another problem. But we're seeing people from the Midlands and the Birmingham area and all that, all traveling to the coast. And honestly, when I was used to be a lifeguard, I could tell you, and I've had somebody come up to my beach then and go, "Is this something to do with climate change?" And I said, "What do you mean by that?" "Well, this time last year, the water line was here, and now it's out right out there. Is that climate change?" And you have to explain about the tides. And they're only 3 hours away from the ocean, you know?
Let's get into just the basics of drowning. And I know, Dr. Morgan, you did research on the myth of dry drowning. Is that correct?
It wasn't research per se. I was involved in some of the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation Science. So it's all the science reviews that go into the international guidelines for resuscitation and similar. And part of that, with the work we did with International Life Saving and the medical committee there, was around how do you measure something where, if we go back 20 years, different areas, even within the same country, were using different definitions of drowning. And if you want to look at data properly, you have to call an apple, and you can't compare apples and oranges. I know that seems very simplistic as a breakdown, but if we say, right, drowning is, oh, it's immersion or submersion in water, the results of which are either death, you don't die, but if you don't die, you might have some morbidity or disability or no disability. Now, suddenly that's really quite clear. And then people say, well, hang on a minute, what about secondary drowning? What about near drowning? What about dry drowning? And when you say to explain to people, well, what does that actually mean? You haven't had a second episode of drowning. It's the same drowning process that started when they inhaled water. It's just at the point at which they've been rescued, you can't clinically detect it. It's the same in the same way when we send children to school with, say, chicken pox or measles. They've had measles for 5 days before they have symptoms. It's the same with what used to be secondary drowning. If people have inhaled sufficient amounts of water, they can have problems up to 48, 72 hours later, but it's still the same drowning problem. They've not suddenly had another drowning event. It's the same one. It's just now become more applicable. And so, with that kind of trying to simplify the definition so that we can actually use comparators so that we can compare UK data with the US, with Australia, with worldwide. So we can actually then get a proper picture of what drowning is. We were able to say things like dry drowning. It doesn't matter if you're the person who's had the accident, it doesn't matter whether there's water in your lungs or not. You've had the worst day of your life and you need rescuing. Then you need resuscitating. And it doesn't matter whether there's water in your lungs or not, it's still the same rescue. And AD will laugh at me now. When I first lectured to the surf lifeguard instructors and said, and they got all very excited about all these things, they said, right, I'm going to stop you here. If somebody comes out of the water and they're not breathing well, or they've stopped breathing and they're now in cardiac arrest, it's pushy, pushy, blowy, blowy, end of. And they got very, oh, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to push on the chest, pushy, pushy. So what about the oxygen? Well, we need to give them oxygen, blowy, blowy. That's it. Don't complicate it. Because in that moment of stress, they need something simple to hang on to. So we do talk, you know, when we do the formal training, we do talk about danger response, airway, breathing, circulation. But does it matter if you've had a wet drowning or dry drowning event at that point of rescue? Nope. Does it matter when they get to intensive care or they have a pre-hospital critical care doctor? Nope. Because I will look at them, I hate talking about myself, by the way. It's really quite difficult. If I happen on scene as a consultant in pre-hospital critical care and I've got somebody in front of me, I am not going to sit there and scratch my head and cerebrally stroke and go, could it be? I'm going to go, well, hang on, is the airway clear? Well, if it's not, I clear it. Are they breathing effectively? If they're not, I'll provide supplemental oxygenation, maybe supplemental ventilation, or probably both. Do they need some circulatory support? Yes, I'll do that. And by the time you get them to hospital and you hand them over, and they say to you, oh, was it a dry drowning or a wet drowning? And you go, I have no idea. But what I can tell you is, with all my clever gizmos on the back of a helicopter, I did pushy, pushy, blowy, blowy. They're still alive. Could you do your job, please? And they hate me for it because they say, well, surely you're a world expert in all this kind of stuff. I'm not the only one. There are other experts available. But the bottom line is, you do what your casualty needs. So those definitions mean nothing. Near drowning, it's like, well, did you nearly have a heart attack? Well, no, you didn't. You either had one or you hadn't. You can't nearly. What's happened is you've been for a swim in the sea and you've been rescued. But you've not had a drowning event. Every time I go and swim in the sea with AD, he's a fish. I am behind him. It does appear like I'm drowning. It's just poor swimming technique. But I get out, a cough and a splutter. I've not had a drowning event. I've just been rescued by my own self-preservation, but I can't keep up with it. And that's the subtle difference is suddenly you start talking about these things. And you say, well, okay, what is important? Well, a non-fatal drowning event is where you've been rescued from the water and there's an element of respiratory compromise. So your heart rate, sorry, your breathing rate is up, you're coughing up a little bit of foam or phlegm, or if a clinician has a listen to your chest, there's some crackles. So you've had a drowning event and you have been rescued and you're okay, you're not unconscious, you're not in cardiac arrest. You still need some therapies potentially, but have you nearly drowned? Well, no, you've had a drowning event. It's a non-fatal one because you're not dead yet. Now
Right.
you might die if we don't do something about it. So that's where things like secondary drowning, near drowning, and the whole wet dry drowning. We could get very excited about the pathophysiology of whether it's fresh water or salt water, whether there's sand in there or fungus with the sand, because it's actually river sand and not sea sand. It doesn't matter. It only really matters later down the line when we have to do things in intensive care. But if you tell me, oh, they had a drowning event in the sea and it was dumping surf and there's potentially a sandy beach, you go, okay, well, I'll do some fibroscopes down. I'll suck out rubbish from the lungs. That's different. If they say, "Oh, I was in this river," you can say, "Yeah, that's quite a dirty river." I'm not going to treat them necessarily with antibiotics, but I might say, "I'm going to keep a really close eye because very likely they'll have an infection." So in that way, that was where the kind of the research led us was towards that sort of standardized definition. And the key is coming full circle back to prevention. If we know the size of the problem, we know where the problem points are, and we can use things like AD describes the heat maps. We can start to target interventions. What we can also do is we can say, oh, well, what was the difference between pushy, pushy, blowy, blowy, and pushy, pushy, blowy, 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 blowy? Well, if I've now got standardized definitions worldwide, I can now start to do comparisons. So the science gets stronger, the evidence behind our interventions gets stronger. And that's why, and if one of the things that comes away from today's conversation is people using standardized definitions allows us to produce good, strong science. And that strong science actually then allows us to put good quality interventions. As a prime example, in Southern Ireland, sorry, the Republic of Ireland, they'll tell me off, given my good ladies from Northern Ireland, she'll be shouting at me through the walls in a minute. In the Republic of Ireland, there's a chap, Gareth Morrison, working for the Royal National Lifeboat Institute, recognised actually where are the problems? And the problems, as AD alluded to, it tends not to be the people who work and fish in and around the coast because they have that cultural awareness. It's those that visit the coast. So he looked at it and said, well, him and a few of his colleagues, and said, well, what is common to those people who come to the coast? What's the kind of broadest thing we can get? And in the Republic of Ireland, there's a game, Gaelic football. It's kind of a brutal combination of American football, hockey, and standard soccer without any protection. It's a fantastic game. But the Gaelic Football Association, I know it's one
Are
to
we
look at.
talking rugby? No.
No, that's quite
Not
easy compared to
quite.
this game.
It's more brutal than rugby. They will kick the ball like a football, like a soccer ball, but they'll also pick it up and throw it. And they can literally batter each other and tackle them. But unlike American football, they won't be wearing any padding or armor.
Correct.
But these clubs, so the Gaelic Football Association, they have other sports that they play in the same sports clubs. But every small village and every small town in the Republic of Ireland has a Gaelic Football Association club. So the RNLI said, well, let's partner with them. And they loved it. So you can imagine. So to give it context, could you imagine going to the Super Bowl and in the middle of the Super Bowl, somebody drags out a lifeboat and then shows a video of how to float to live? Suddenly you've got an entire nation at your fingertips. And
That
it
is
was that.
amazing. You just said that.
It
Going
is.
on.
It's worth looking at. So
Well,
look
I
at
did.
the GAA, so the Gaelic Athletic Association and the RNLI partnership. So those kind of key partnerships between water safety groups and the communities, where it's the communities that need that cultural change in education. Some really powerful videos it's worth looking into. And what that has done is it's reduced drowning deaths and accidents in the Republic of Ireland. It's phenomenal that the amount of work they've done.
So there is actually advertising. You're telling me they went in front of an event with the lifeboats and presented something to a mass of people who have come to watch the game, right? Which makes, and they're attentive there. So you've got their attention. They can't go anywhere, or they probably
Absolutely.
won't. Wow.
And like I say, if you look at the All-Ireland final, in terms of Ireland, that is bigger than the Super Bowl as far as that population is concerned. So when you're bringing out a huge lifeboat, Shannon class, you've got lifeboat crew stood there, you've got a big Float to Live campaign, it's put on all the big video screens. And at the same time, they're also going into all the clubs as well and actually delivering these water safety messages. It's incredibly powerful. Could you imagine doing that to every college and every school in the United States where American football is played?
That's
You would hit
excellent.
competition really
What do
quickly.
you think? What do you think, Adrian? That's interesting because I was just talking to a woman who runs the National Drowning Prevention Alliance in the United States, and she's pairing up with just one guy who lost his son, and it's called Wave Makers, and they're going to every baseball game
Perfect.
in the United States where they do the wave, then they're going to present something. But this sounds even more impactful, actually.
It's about getting that message across, and it's the it, drowning is the epidemic silent killer. It's the one that's always neglected by every single nation. Yeah, it's the
Right.
one that gets everybody. You know, globally, it's under 10-year-olds in the top three in the world. So we have a problem that is very, very similar to any country in the world. So everybody knows that under 12-year-olds are a big problem. Then we have that. If you pulled out every single drowning statistic, they'd probably look very, very similar. I think the only thing slightly different now in drowning deaths is for a Western nation, America's the first time now where we see flood disaster having more deaths than pool and ocean combined.
Yeah.
So we're seeing a climate change impact on that. But that won't be long with other countries. However, by not utilizing and responding to it, will only lead to. And prevention is the biggest thing that we can do. There's a really good paper by Dr. David Spilsman that looked at drowning prevention in the chain of survival. And if you do all your prevention work, it works out something like 99.9% prevention work. And really, the CPR bit, the pumpy, pumpy, blowy, blowy, and the sparky, sparky with it will
Okay.
be down to
Good.
0.1%.
I want to stop you because I want to know about the prevention piece, and there's so much I want to talk. I could talk to both of you for 3 hours, but the pumpy, pumpy, blowy, blowy, sparky,
Put
sparky.
that on a t-shirt in your life-saving school. There you go. Teach first aid.
Can we just back up a little bit? If we do the prevention, what is the prevention at a system level? Because here, I have to say honestly, it's not a priority, or we would have
It's
passed.
ground. It's
It's a
ground truth.
yeah, that's.
If your base is big, then your single point is zero, and that's what the evidence was. I think if you it worked out, Paddy, remind me, things like 0.1%, and the likelihood that you're doing CPR on somebody is about once every 50 years. So that's a nice statistic that if you come across it, you not ever do it again. But that's because the fundamental strong base and foundations of prevention goes before intervention of any type. So if you want to reduce that base, because let's just talk at the your numbers are 5,000, our numbers just not far from that. If you that does not take into account the amount of prevention work there is, but if you is going on. But it's the iceberg under the water. But that's got to be more because our population's growing. We're getting warmer, we're getting wetter, and we're having that. So the probability and likelihood's only going to go up. So it should be matched by the prevention strategy of setting the legacy. You might not see it for the first few years, but having a strong prevention legacy that is back supported by regional, state, and local governments that can go into schools on a nationwide program. starts to create the legacy going through. But we've got to catch those areas of youngsters when they're like 5 or 6, when they start to be before they start being wild teenagers, grabbing them then, and before they leave the safety of schools and colleges, another reminder, and that will set them up for a family. And then we can get the results back and start to see those areas. But we've got to have, be strong in doing that. And that's the only way forward, a good, strong prevention strategy that covers all bases.
Well, we've got $1 billion worth of damage from a flood, right? We haven't seen that kind of thing. And on top of that, you've talked to me before about that because now we have leptospirosis, which is common in some of our still water, but now it's really a big deal because there's still water everywhere. It's coming out of everywhere and dogs are getting it, and then it spreads to humans, and then we've got the mold situation. We have this whole health piece. It appears to me, in anything to do with emergency management and water safety, should be in there. It should be part of all of that.
And I think that's the way to do, look at it seasonal and look at the side bits come out like the flood. And so, you know, we all know what happens in winter, we all know what happens in summer and spring and fall. So understanding those particular, drowning is drowning, but the risks are specific to seasonal sometimes. And then, and you know when you've got your hurricane season, you know when you're going to have your flooding. So around the, you know, the same thing, float to live, good hygiene. But look after yourself, fresh water, boil your water, and stay out of flood water. You only need a little cut. Paddy can tell you more about this than I can, but you only need a little cut on contaminated water. And what we would say is a response level and in incident management is that any kind of flood water is a biohazard. So treat it. You wouldn't go and jump in a toxic waste. So why would you go and jump in and play in flood water? I mean, I'll let Paddy talk about the other side of that. I would
Okay.
jump out. Go, Paddy.
Go, Patty.
Thank
Because
you.
I wish this was actually, once we get this going and I could have video, this would be so entertaining. More people would want to watch it. But this is all just going to be audio. But Dr. Moore, I.
The danger is when they've got the three of us together, we've worked together for a very long time to the point we've got very strong friendships. So some of our kind of unique comedy may come out as well. So, but I'll behave today. I'll behave.
Well, we'll have to shoot for the deal when our podcast gets more sophisticated because we're a grass shack in the jungle. But here we have something called Surf Rider Foundation, and they go around testing the waters, and they're telling us how polluted they are all the time. But people say to me, well, I'm not jumping in, but you could still get infected just by in your mouth, your eyes, you're getting splashed. Is that correct?
Loaded
No.
question. I like it. Yes, is the honest answer. There is, as ever, there's always a spectrum with all these things. There is, when you look at the contamination data, if you take a piece of water, it will have something in it. If it's a natural body of water, it will have things in it. So it may be E. coli, it may be leptospirosis. When you've had mass flooding, things like hepatitis A can float around in the debris. Because, of course, the water is not just the water, it's also got things in it. So, everything from feces, if it's flooded drains, to pesticides, chemicals from runoff from the fields to which the water's come through. So, of course, those hazards are not just bacterial or viral, they're also chemical. We have a problem, slightly aside from flooding, we have a problem in the UK Channel with migrant boats collapsing because they're poor quality boats and the fuel tanks burst. So we now have children in salty water with petrol burns and chemical corrosion. That happens in floods as well. You can imagine that the silo of manure that the farmers are using during that flood, that silo comes over, that's now on the ground, and that's now all washing into those water bodies people are then using. But to come back to the question, the question is, what do you do with flood? And the first thing to recognize is that floods come in different stages from the person, from the casualty perspective. The first is the preparation for. So, as Aidy said, you know when the seasons are coming, you know when the hurricanes are coming over the horizon. So, that's where you have the conversation with the family before it arrives. And you say, right then, boys and girls, when it happens, here's the plan. We're going to go upstairs if we've got a second floor. or we're going to go onto the roof, or we're going to go to Aunt Maeve's house because she lives on the top of the hill, and we're going to take with us our bag. And our survival bag is going to have those key things that we need to survive. Now, they are normally in priority order, oxygen, pretty fundamental for life. And as long as you can still breathe and stay above the water, happy days. You've then got heat management, so staying warm and not too wet or cold. Food, always good. Shelter, always good. And as far as my teenage children are concerned, Wi-Fi access, though that can be missed off in the flood scenario. But if you're going and you've got your bag of goodies and you say, right, well, I've got spare undies, I've got a jumper, I've got a torch, we've got some water, I've got some chlorine tablets so I can actually take water, filter it, and clean it. Well, I've now sorted out hydration. I'm going to stay breathing. I've got some light. I've got some warmth temporarily to go upstairs because, of course, in a mass flooding, suddenly you're going to lose potentially power. You may lose access to gas heating or oil heating, depending on how your heating's sourced. And it's going to get dark. And because there are so many people there, that's the next little secret that nobody lets you know. In a disaster, you never have enough resource to do what you want to do. So from a rescue perspective, you're now in triage. I need to decide if I have 100 people and I've got one rescue boat, I can't get all 100. So I have to pick the sickest of the sickest. And the medical emergency services will have triage plans to work out who's the sickest. But if you're not the sickest, you're going nowhere. You're staying put. And so again, it's back to, right, okay, I'm going to put some fluids in my bag. I'm going to put some, like I said, chlorine tablets. I'm going to put some snacks in there, some high energy fruits, that kind of stuff. And Aunt Maeve is going to have a house full. So we might as well take a bag of rice and, we're going to go and live on the top of the hill for a few days, potentially. The next phase, then, as we allude to, is the recovery phase where the floodwater starts to die down. And now you've got lack of infrastructure. You might still not have power. You might still not have gas or oil. You also might not have a house to go back to. So you've got no accommodation. You may not necessarily have vehicles to get to and from work. And general industry is going to be struggling to get back on top of things because they've also got flood damage as well. But then so is all the local supermarkets. So where are you going to get your food from? Because now it's all covered in, it's all spoiled. It's dead. Or there's no fresh food coming in around. So it's then that next phase is that's actually almost the most dangerous phase. That flood bit is quite short and sharp. Again, depending on the conditions, but that's where you get your flash drownings. That's where you get people injured, trapped, and they're actually the things that emergency services are actually quite used to looking after because that's what we do day to day. It's just there's a lot of it. But in that recovery phase where you've now got widespread flood water, which will be contaminated with both, like we said, bacteria, viruses, fungus, as well as chemicals. It's actually then the lack of those basics of heat, warmth, food, fluids. Where's that going to come from? How are we going to look after that? And then you're into the next phase of, well, okay, so I broke my ankle. So I wasn't the sickest of the sickest, but I broke my ankle and cut it at the same time. Well, you're now 2, 3 days down the line, you're into infection territory. And those infections, as AD alluded to, they can be the nasty things, the leptospirosis, the E. coli's, but it might actually be really simple, straightforward Staphylococcus, Streptococcus that live in our skin normally, but you're not in normal conditions now. You haven't got heat, you haven't got warmth, you haven't necessarily got the right foods and fluids, you haven't got access to antibiotics or somewhere to clean those wounds. So it becomes a case of survival. And the difference between survival and thriving is actually that preparation. And it's actually knowing, okay, let's keep this simple. You've got a cut on your leg, right? Soap and fresh water, let's give it a clean. And actually, there is still a risk of infection, but you've significantly reduced it by keeping it fresh, avoiding letting the children go and play in the what essentially now is a widespread sewer in the back garden. Simple things actually prevent that next stage. From an emergency services perspective, that's where you end up with these, and the US and Hawaii are very good at this about having those tiered responses. But even with tiered responses, Hawaii is quite a long way from the mainland. So if you need external infrastructure to come in and assist, it's a long time coming.
Yes,
So
it is.
you're on your own for a little bit. And that's awful to say. We have similar problems here in the UK because my other role is I'm the medical director for His Majesty's Coast Guard. And so we've got the Orkneys and the Shetlands, which are not quite as warm because described as Hawaii, but they are as remote, even though they're not geographically as far away. But when we get bad weather, we can have patients and casualties stuck on Orkney and the Shetlands for days at a time. And that's okay because they've got some healthcare there. But if we suddenly have five or six people, that's now a major incident because they've only got a population of 100. And if 5%, 10% of your population is now injured or unwell because of a bus crash, that's a major incident. And we can't get to you because the weather's too bad, the boat's going to take 2 days, the aircraft can't fly in. Suddenly it's the same problem. And it's back to that things of simple things done well. The foundations of care are really important.
Yes.
Like I said, I can come in with my, multi-million pound helicopter with all the sexy
A van
Claire.
with a fan. A van with a fan. Don't make it too sexy. Van with a fan.
Van with a fan. Thanks, Aidy. You realize there's a load of helicopter EMS getting rid
Minute,
of.
wait a minute. You can come in with the sexy helicopter. I have to just say that we just got another helicopter here on Kauai to
Get
rescue
in.
people from the Nepali Kalalau Trail, which we have injuries every day almost, people. And then they call for help, and that helicopter is taken away from actually getting somebody over to Oahu for critical care. So now we have a second helicopter.
And of
But
course, every helicopter, it needs fuel. And when your fuel's spoiled because the tank's been taken out in the flood and the weather's not bad or the engineer can't get in to service it, suddenly it's a very static van with a fan that's not going anywhere.
this is very depressing because I look at the geography of Hawaii and I see where we are, 2,500 miles from the mainland, 5,000 miles from the rest of the world. I'm going, wow, we're really out in the middle of nowhere. And you're exactly right. I mean, it's kind of a sketchy situation right now with energy and everything else, but.
Absolutely. Well, as all these things, hindsight is a wonderful thing. And I can tell you, if you read any major incident, mass rescue operations document about how we got it wrong and how we got it right, the key things always come through. Communication. There's communication at the time, communication prior to the event, communications after the event as to how we don't forget. The
Right.
ability of corporate memory to go, is this the first time we've had floods in Hawaii? No, it's not. Did we make the same mistakes as last time? I'm not going to make any judgment calls, but I suspect when you read that paper, there'll be a few, yeah, we did something similar. Because don't get me wrong, we've done it as well in the UK. We forget what we did right, and we forget what we didn't do quite as well that we could do better.
You
And
should
the
send
thing
me a
about
link to that paper. That sounds very interesting. I would like to read that. I would like to go on to what Mike Tipton and Adrian had told me before about the critical first minute of a drowning and then first responders. Because in the United States, lifeguards are not considered first responders. And we're trying to make that case because they're usually the first person on the scene and they probably know more about what's going on. And they're not always asked about what happened, like you said. Well, were they on Big Surf? Whatever. So, Adrian, you want to start with that?
I mean, really, the lifeguards are trained to the highest level that they can do, and I think that's they're often overlooked of the typical blonde-haired kind of Point Break dude, and
Baywatch.
that actually, yeah. And as much as Baywatch did a lot to do with bring drowning prevention into the TV in front of millions of viewers, and it did a good job of that, it also sort of changed the shape in which where we thought people would be operating from, so. They are no different on a tower than is no different from a firefighter on a station or a police responder. They are there to do the job. They, and using Paddy's words here quite often, they don't need to use big long words like wheelbarrow and and what's going on in the chest. They just need to do the basics. That's why Paddy and I always try and use basic words because they don't need what they need to do is get from a bad place to a good place with a victim and start that pre-hospital care the moment they get out of the water. So, are they doing the same thing? Yes, of course. Should they be recognised? Yes, of course. And then, what their part of their role is with lifeguards and lifesavers around the world is that next step where they're getting ready for the grown-ups to arrive, that they're preparing this person, and they might be working onto them for 10, 15, 20 minutes, even an hour there, and they're on their own until help arrives. So they should be recognised for the valiant work that they do, and that. that patient ready, that patient phase ready from when they're going from the beach to definitive care. Because as Paddy alluded to earlier on, it's about those changing phases of rescue going through the systems, through the gears that allows that person to either survive or not survive, or have long-term living problems with health or whatever it is that's going on with them. So to be recognised as that, and for us, for example, in Surf Life Saving, that our lifeguards got recognised through no different from the response from Coast Guard or Police and Fire by giving the King's Medal, you know, in terms of the years of service towards that 5 year service or what, a 10 year service. So in my way, I'll be waving a flag because I'm as proud as I am working as a lifeguard as I am as working as a firefighter in my day. You know, the jobs are still the same. You're still pulling people out of a bad place and you're getting them ready for the next thing. So I think, where are we now? I think it's massively improved. But there's still work to be done to be seen that the knowledge they carry, the skills that they carry, and the fitness they carry is, and all that combined, you'd be looking at somebody with 20 years experience, and we should almost like, wow, you know, how to read the ocean in terms of water. You know, I think there's a study in Australia that 92% of people in Australia couldn't understand what a rip is or see a rip.
Right.
You know, and so that's really important. But that just shows you where the lifeguards have seen in Australia, and it'd be nice to see the same sort of people in our island. But it's looking our like they are now slowly, but it's taking years and years and years of getting rid of that Bill and Ted dude adventure thing and realizing these people are highly skilled,
Yes.
wild
Yes.
stallions.
A paper that I've just popped into the chat. So one of my then trainees, he's now one of my consultant colleagues, did a comparator between Baywatch resuscitation survival and those of LA County lifeguards, and actually had it published. It's a very good paper. My colleague is he's got very good dry wit, but what it does point out is that Baywatch did a huge amount of work for drowning prevention. They actually introduced the concept of lifeguards, and people went to train. The other thing that that paper did was it was kind of a trigger point for me personally to say, yeah, actually, our lifeguards are brilliant, but how do I convince UK government that our lifeguards are worth it? And then you have to say, well, it's not just lifeguards. How do we recognise all first responders? And some of the work that we've done on a national level is actually working with UK Search and Rescue, which is a collection of mountain rescue, cave, as well as ambulance, police, fire. And some of the other specialist rescue services around, how do we standardize? Because when the flares go off and the big bang happens of that flood rescue, that mass flooding event, well, when De Bill and Ted do rock up with their surfboards, how do I know what they can't do if I'm with the ambulance service as a commander on scene? Well, now in the UK, we've said, okay, well, the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh did a what they call a FEM framework, so pre-hospital emergency medicine skills framework, and it was a an A to G skills framework. So G is consultant level doctor, A is I've done 8 hours first aid 1 day course, and where do you sit? But that's not quite good enough for lifeguards and for search and rescue because, funny enough, our lifeguards are incredibly competent in wet, cold, drowned people. Those wet, wiggly fishes that are really hard to handle and get out of the water and move up a beach, they're brilliant at. You give that to a paramedic on the back of an ambulance, they're not as good at it because it's not what they do. And the standard joke in these meetings was, well, when the tarmac stops, that's when search and rescue begins. And so, how do you now quantify that? So, we've just recently finished doing the UK SAR framework, which is then aligns to that pre-hospital framework, which are major. So in the UK, we have the Enhanced Capabilities Unit, which looks after all the ambulance services, special responses to major incidents. So they now have that framework. So we can say, well, our surf lifeguards are level two on the UK SAR FEM framework. And they go, right, okay. So if somebody turns up with their lifeguard ticket from one of the main organizations, they know they're at level two. If somebody from Mountain Rescue turns up because they carry extra drugs, they can turn and go, yep, yeah, level three. And we go, brilliant, I've got a level three. Now, in the flood world as well, we have our flood risk. This is AD specialism, so that's great. He's telling you mine, I'm telling you his. It's brilliant. There's the National Flood Risk, National Flood Register, which actually has, again, standardization of teams. So whether you're a type A team, B team, so on and so forth. and that determines what skill set they have. So, of course, if we now turn up and we say, correct me if I'm wrong, AD, yeah, we're level two Yakai SAR medically, but we're a type B team and we've got the kit. As a commander on scene, you're going, great, I now know your capability. Because any decision, and one of my favorite speeches is actually Roosevelt's speech, The Man in the Field, after he lost, is when he lost the second, he lost his re-election. And he talks about making a decision in the now, and it's better to make a decision, but the more information you have at your hand to make a sound decision, the better. And so if I'm the commander on scene and I know I've got a type B team with a level two Yakai SAR medical response, I know what they can do, so I can deploy them safely. If I don't know, if I've got to take the rap for it and I'm the one that's got to stand in the public inquiry, I'm not going to deploy you because I don't want to put you in danger because you tell me you did a first aid ticket with Bob 6 years ago. I'm really sorry. Go and stay in the car park. You're not getting engaged in this rescue. But that's taken a lot of years of actually standardizing lifeguard medical education, a lot of years of convincing people actually, we're all talking the same. You know, and again, back to standardization. Now, appreciate in the UK, it's been slightly easier that we've had some big hitters on our side from a medical legal perspective. And within Hawaii and the rest of the US, there are different states will have different medical processes and litigation processes and what's allowed and what's not allowed. And we've done, funny enough, I listened to Justin Semsprott, he's a good friend of ours. And when you listen to Justin, he talks about it. And when I was briefly doing some work for Remote Medical International, we had doctors in different states in the US. What they can and cannot do, it was incredible. And the fact they have to have different board exams, even though they may be working half a mile away from where, it blew my mind. And part of that is around how do you protect the individual from people who are telling porky or telling fibs about how medically qualified they are or they aren't. How do you ensure the safety for patients generally day to day? Well, then it comes on to who trains your lifeguards? What standards do they sit to? Is it a national standard they work to? Because if it's a national standard across the whole of the US and Hawaii, then that can be aligned and you can say, well, actually, Medical Board of Hawaii, I'm not sure who does it, but Medical Board of Hawaii, these guys meet this standard, which is this level. So EMS is here. They're here, so they can be trusted with X, Y, and Z. The next stage then,
Go ahead. No.
was going to say, so the next stage then is once you've got that standardized, well, this is where we sit, this is where you sit, this is how we can play together, is you make them play together, get them to practice and train together. So again, one of the key things in the UK we recognize is our response to major incidents. Key things always fail, communications. Key things always shine through, individual brilliance. And it's how do we support individual brilliance and we make the lowest common denominator is the best they can be, whilst not stopping that individual brilliance. And it's about getting people to work together to say, oh, you do it that way, we do it this way. Why is it different? What's the evidence? Let's do this. So we actually have now local resilience forums where, excuse me, we encourage all the emergency services that they may respond together. So the lifeguards, the ambulance service, the police, the fire service, the critical care, the Coast Guard, the RNLI, the independent lifeboats, they'll all come together to respond to that kind of exercise. And then some days that's a live exercise on a beach or in the sea. Or funny enough, AD and I actually went to the same major incident exercise. He was in one type of orange suit, I was in a different type of orange suit. And they looked utterly bemused when he gave me a hug, and then we went and just started doing what we did. And these people go, but how do you? And it was a flooded water park, and we were delivered casualties, and it was fantastic because suddenly people recognize it's okay to have relationships with other emergency services. It's okay to learn best practice from somebody who isn't necessarily your station commander. And you're thinking, oh, well, that's a really good idea. Let's share that knowledge. And the more frequently you work together, you play together, as it were, the better you are when the big job comes. Because, as we allude to, there are seasons, and not every season will develop into a major mass scale incident. But when it does, if you turn up and you've got the same fire officer with the same ambulance officer and the same Coast Guard officer and the same lifeguard officer, and they go, great, guys, can you go and do this? Can you go and do this? Suddenly it's a more effective response. and it's a safer response. And that's probably one of the key things, because any of these incidents, they all then have to be defended later at some kind of public inquiry or investigation to see if we all did what we said we'd do and we did it as well as we can.
That's so well said. And we have that issue here, communication, communication. You're talking about having a framework and system and working together. And I'm not sure if I've ever seen that here, but I know that Justin Semstra will be involved in the first responder roundup in California. The beginning of May, then he's going to come back on our show and talk because it made a big difference. And that is bringing first responders and first lifeguards aren't considered first responders, but they're bringing everyone involved in rescue together to do training. And he's going to be the trainer, I guess, for a couple of days. So,
And the other thing that I know is kind of touching back a bit,
yeah.
in terms of changing culture, one of the questions you have to ask is, what's in it for me? And you have to ask that at every level, the child at school, the parents, the local business person, the local council, the government, what's in it for me? And at each of those levels, you have to sell it in a subtly different way. So at
Yes.
the governmental level, where, so Professor Tipton and I and a couple of others are just, we're in the process of publishing a paper looking at the cost of death following drowning. So we took a year's data and we said, right, about 600 people, 300 were
Gonna stop you
accidental
right there. I need that paper because
deaths. As soon as it's
everybody
published, I will send it over.
is saying that we don't have the message. And when Mike Tipton came on and talked about years of life lost, I didn't really had never thought of that before. And then 6 months later, after hearing everybody talk, this is crazy. We can't, people say, what is it going to cost us? That's what they're saying at the government level. So at Ways and Means and Finance, they just stop. We like your idea. This is great, but we don't have the money, you know? So go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I'm
Tell me
so
about your paper.
the paper's currently in the process of going through the editorial process. It's been submitted, it's not quite there yet. But the kind of the takeaway message is, of the 300 accidental deaths, so excluding suicide and homicide, 300 accidental deaths, the number of life years lost. So if you say a two-year-old dies, they've effectively got 63 years worth of effective earnings in UK PLC,
Right.
and that equates to a number. Now, when you multiply that number up, those 300 deaths, because drowning affects quite a large proportion of younger people, teenagers, et cetera, the value of that is approximately £450 million for 1 year. 300 people, £450 million, approximately. I mean, the details are in the paper. But when you
Okay.
suddenly say this to a group and you say, this is what you're losing for the ones who die. Now, the ones who don't die, who have severe disability from that hypoxic brain injury, they're still a life loss because they're no longer contributing to society. They're actually costing society. And we don't really like to talk about that. But you're not going to switch off my loved one because I'm costing your society. That's my brother, my sister, my mum, my dad. But there's still a cost there. If you then take it to the what's in it for me when that flood happens. And this is the sell when they're talking about not letting first responders be first responders. If you're going to say to me, right, I'm a lifeguard and I live next door to Mrs. Miggins, and Mrs. Miggins is now drowning in her water, you're not going to stop me rescuing her. You will not stop me going and helping my neighbours. You will not stop me pulling out inferior equipment because you won't be make me part of your infrastructure and attempting rescue. Because that's the other key thing we find in every major instance is the general public want to help each other. It's part of our survival instinct that I will help my neighbours because they're next to me. So the call then to the governmental side is to say, well, they're going to do it anyway. Why not bring them under the banner? Let's ensure they're all meeting the standard, and then they can play for us rather than playing against us when we're in the field of battle. And that's a really key thing. And I know Aidy's done some work in Tasmania with the Australian and the Australian groups around. How do we take lifeguards, once we've got them first responder accredited, how do we make them safe to work in those bodies of water where they're not necessarily trained to do so? Because, of course, a surf lifeguard isn't naturally a flood rescue technician. But I tell you what, they need very minimal training to get them up to speed because they are water people in the first place. if I take a swimming pool lifeguard, that's a lot more to get them into a swift water rescue technician, but it can be done. But they've still got the core clinical skills, the core medical ability. So again, there's that little bit around, okay, rather than fighting against them, let's play together. Let's bring them into the fold because they're going to do it anyway, but let's make it safer. And then actually, generally, they tend to be a free resource because they don't want to get paid to rescue their neighbors, but they're very happy to do it if they've got Hawaii flood rescue across the front of their chest. They'll do it for, partly for the kudos, partly because it's their neighbors. And from a governmental perspective, great. We've now got people branded, trained, and competent. And so if something does happen, I'm not responsible for saying, oh, I was a member of public and they were in danger and I didn't act. Actually, conversely, we did act because we made sure they were adequately trained and resourced to be in that environment. And if there was a problem, it's the individual's error for getting it wrong. And as
I
I'm
agree with Pat, Paddy. I love what you're just saying there, because one of the things when I was doing flood, you give somebody training and you provide kit and you give equipment, they become an asset. Doesn't matter what it is, and that's what you want, is assets on the ground. You know, whether it's a lifeguard asset or a first responder medical asset, you give kit, training, and equipment, and then you have assets.
It's a really good point. So, what did you do in Tasmania? I just want to hear that little bit before.
Yeah, well, they got it was amazing what the government did over there. They recognized back in 2016, 17 that they had flood, and it cost them billions of dollars out there. And what they're going to do, and the chief executive officer of Surf Life Saving Tasmania came over. We did a couple of weeks with him, trained him, and we took him out to our friends in North Carolina and Emergency Management and Charlotte Fire Department, who are the best of the best in flood rescue. And we learned from them. All the UK response came from them, those that body there, and nice relationships that we have with them. And that led to seeing the troubles in Australia. We asked Charlotte Fire Department to come out with us, and we delivered a program out there to deliver the training. And that has led to major floods. And now all the states are involved in flood rescue response. What did the state governments do? They all put in $200 million each, and the government put in another $4 billion on top to get the program going.
Wow.
So it was a huge response. And then almost 6 months later, we had the biggest flooding ever recorded, and then another one the year after that. They were pulling lifeguards from all over the states, and they spent 4 months rotating their crews to deal with flooding. So it was a fantastic result in sharing what we learned from North Carolina and Charlotte Fire Department, what we shared from and our best practice of the UK, we took to Australia. Now, with the government funding, they've excelled, gone past the UK in their response and things like that. So that they are doing really, it just shows you, and actually just showing Europe now, where we see the same things we've done in Europe under the European Flood Rescue program back in the early 2010s, that when you get local government, regional, state government behind you, you get people trained with equipment, you have free assets that can make a difference. When that call goes up and they're coordinated, they are interoperable with those of the emergency response. They are coordinated through your federal systems, and therefore they can make a huge impact. And then that impact, you know, over the flooding is really important. Not just that, after that preparedness of all practice, training, sharing, and all that, but the moment we have those flash floodings, the second bit when we have what we call phase three, which is expansive floods, where water is moving lateral and covering your real estate. And then the most important part with our lifeguards then is they can come in on the last phase, which is Paddy's talked about, is that medical response. We're first aiders. We can provide that cover where you can literally obliterate your ambulance services because you're dealing with thousands of people, and they need to be there to deal with the major emergencies, and we can be there to do hearts and minds, drinking, vulnerability assessments, cleaning plasters and wounds. You know, let's pick the low-hanging fruit that makes the big difference and delays the clinical problems a bit later for when people like Paddy and Nat have to come along and start bringing them in. Because if there's nobody there, that problem's only going to escalate over time. So let's get in there and have trained people. And when you looked at the I think we did the costing, I'm just going to pull a slide in, and I think I sent it to you, but if I looked at what that meant for the UK, give you an idea of the Australian floods that cost $7.7 billion in Western Australia. And then they looked at that and they took that one element out of businesses lost 324 million, and then people affected was $84 million. Now, if you took those numbers and used the UK model of what the government did to set up under the Flood Rescue Enhancement Project, 36 million outlay over 12 years. So it works out, a couple of million each year. Well, that's 36 million. That's less than half of one major flood event. It's less than half of the element of the people affected at 84 million. So you've got $7.7 billion major flood. Out of that segment, people affected $84 million. And for 12 years, if a government put in 36 million over 12 years, you have paid for that less than half. And you're getting people, and this is very much Paddy's talking about. The people are not contributing, the more it affects governments economically, and also affects people's family life. So if we can get them from a bad place to a good place, clean, ready to go, get infrastructure back, and it's part of the four priorities in our Sendai report of build back better. It's the fourth priority. Let's build back better, get people back to work and get to family life, because as soon as we can, the economy starts to spin up again. If we're not, and we're not doing that, then the economy drags and slows down, and people start affected, and lives are affected over not just months, but years and tens of years. And for what is $2 million a year to create an effective service for when it happens, and it happens again and again, you have paid for it and you're saving money. And the problem is, we need to get governments to realize by putting a couple of million dollars a year for rescue response for volunteer assets is nothing to the billions of pounds that you'll be paying if you're not doing that. And that's very much identified in the UN Sendai framework.
That's excellent. I don't think I got the slide, so I want the slide. And
I've sent it to you. Yeah, I've sent
okay,
it to you.
so you and Dr. Morgan would be great, along with Mike Tipton, to do a presentation to our governor, who is a physician. So, and he's an
Well, the
economist.
slides I just sent you are almost the version of the ones I did in Australia that led to the money that was used. They realized, and
I'll have to
the
give
big
you.
impression was flood was that you didn't in every graph in every country. If you go for every 50 years, you see small, then you see an impact of the industrial level of revolution kind of thing going up. And then if you look at since 2000 to 2050, we're at 2026 now. We're already double the amount of floods from the last 50 years. So we're exponentially growing now in flood disaster.
That's great. I really appreciate what you just said. And when I can get this podcast, great, I'll be taking those cuts from this to put out. But we're at that situation where everyone's saying to people are putting through legislation, well, what is this going to cost? And everybody's telling me they've got to get the message better for legislatures, the government to understand and
I'm going to share you
develop.
something which almost covers some of the bits we've already done. Is a
Okay.
great man from North Carolina, Jeff Cardwell, did this, and I mentioned him because he's a legend in my world. And he put the mnemonic failure, and it says failure to understand the dynamics of water or hydrology. A is the additional medical considerations, both physiological effects of cold and fast moving water not taken into account. Inadequate training in rescue techniques. L for a lack of teamwork, which goes for exactly what Paddy's been talking about. U to underestimating the rescue logistics scale, which is again what Paddy's mentioned earlier. And then R is the rescue recovery, no distinction made. And again, we've been talking about this, and equipment unsuitable for the task. And if you haven't got those things, you will have failure on your site. So that's
Wow.
something for the guests to remember and write down.
Yes. Are you sending me that information?
I will send that slide across to you as well.
You guys are amazing. You're just, next time we're going to have you back on, all three of you. But I saw that you're talking about you went to North Carolina and you've told me that before, Adrian. I have to give I guess a shout out to Kalani Vieira, who's head of all the lifeguards here and president of the Hawaii Lifeguard Association, who's been helping the Okinawan lifeguards. And I didn't know much about Okinawa, but they have a million and a half people and they have no lifeguards, very few. So they were learning about jet ski rescues and were considered pretty elite in that range. So this is the second season. He had them back to learn and to understand from our guards, which is great. I didn't know what was going on, but I interviewed Bruce Hopkins and we were talking about messaging, which is one of the things we keep coming back to. What's wrong with our messaging? We keep getting it out, but people keep doing all the wrong things. So Bruce Hopkins said, well, I'm trying to figure out rip currents and we have all these signs. And I realized after I was supposed to go on a skydiving incident for Bondi Rescue, which he's part of. And I read everything about it and I thought, I know everything about this. I got up there and I froze. And then he realized, I got to get people to experience a rip because we talk about them as some horrible thing. Then we tell them not to panic and that they should be just floating, just like Mike and everybody said here, float to live. So I thought that was kind of a great idea because we have people going into the ocean here. They go all in the wrong places and they have to be rescued. So I'm thinking, well, let's try a different kind of messaging. Instead of having these signs up, we'll bring this guy out and we'll do this. But I wasn't sure it was going to happen. So we had a Zoom call with Bruce Hopkins, myself, and Kalani. He's sitting here listening. We thought he's going to say, well, let me think about it. And he said, can you come? This is like 5 weeks before it happened. Can you come at this time? I have the Okinawan lifeguards. Could you come and do this? He goes, yeah, I can come from Sunday to Friday. He goes, good, we'll do it. So
Wow.
we did the first rip current clinic held in Hanalei at the worst time of the year. There's nobody there. It was the middle of the week. It was really cold. And the rain was going like parallel, like it was sheets of rain. We had everybody together, which Dr. Morgan explained. We had the fire department, we had EMTs, we had lifeguards, head of lifeguards from each island, and we had Bruce Hopkins. And it was free, and we invited the public. Well, we had about 80 people,
Wow.
there was 30 of them that went in, and he said, how many of you want to go in? He figured nobody would, but they did. So they experienced that and they came out feeling like they understood something about a rip current and about floating, right? And so I thought we had done something good, but that's getting off this topic. But it is part of the conversation about water
Here's
safety.
your friend. You make a valuable point because for lifeguards now, it is a friend for us and surfers. You know, we choose that when we look at it, and the famous, surfer with a surfboard watching the ocean. He's counting the sets. He's counting the gaps between the sets, and he's
Yep.
looking for the holes, and then he's looking for the rip to go out. You know, and so it's a friend as it is an enemy, but it's teaching people to know what to do, and I think it's a very valuable resource that you got out there. You know, it's very good, and I think we should do it probably over here where we can show, because very people don't understand what the rip is, and actually you can survive the rip. You just got to calm, float to survive, and then move across, and then it'll bring you back into from the, high pressure going out into low pressure, and it'll bring you back in. So let's not make it scary. You know, yes, you get caught, but let's do the basics. Float to live. You know, when you'll slow down, move out to the side, take your time, and then the waves will bring you back. Don't rush.
People felt like they had actually, they were high-fiving each other.
Yeah.
So sand hoppers is one of the things that you do in the UK, which I find really great because don't you involve the parents in that?
Yeah, parents and children, they go along and they get to play in the ocean, in the shoreline and water, and start to bring them in. And then they learn at a very young preschool age about around water and what to do, and just very basic skills. You know, here's water. Can you go up to it? Can you sit in it? Can you have water splash over your face? That kind of stuff. And then they start to then and you get introduced to that beach culture. So it's very good. And the parents learn. And what we find then is the parents come in and start to become part of the lifesaving community, which is great. They start doing basic tube rescue awards and board rescue awards, and then eventually they've got those elements, and they go, "Well, I'll do my first aid award." And then all of a sudden, they're 2/3 of the way through their lifeguard award, and then you get a lifeguard. So it's great.
Yeah, I think that would be an important piece here because people drop their kids off or something and they're not
Yeah.
involved in it. And I
No, we
think
grab them. We handcuff them to the Not
well,
literally. But it's an important part of the sandhoppers and the kind of next level up, the nippers, was we needed the parents, because in terms of UK law, there's elements around how many you can have for safety, when you can and cannot take. And suddenly you're taking a lot of responsibility if you're taking a child off and it's all voluntary and all these things. So actually the obvious solution was, well, two birds with one stone. Let's bring the parents in so they know how to safely work in and around the water. They can be part of our voluntary, free, in many cases, kind of teaching and training. And you get the double whammy. You're not becoming an expensive wet babysitter, but you're also teaching the families. And again, it's back to what's in it for me. That sudden culture of awareness of, oh, this is actually quite dangerous. And if my toddler can do it, my 11-year-old is out there swimming in big surf quite happily and safe. How do I get safe now? How do I learn the things that they're talking to me about? And it becomes an infectious spiral. It's fantastic. and we've
It's
had our
part
membership grow because of it. We've gone. Our membership has really, went since Sandhoppers and that community work has gone, we've seen our membership grow, year on year because of it. So it's a, and it, it it. I'll say, I can't say community enough, but it brings in the community. So and they stay, and then the next generation comes through, and they might go off to university, come back, and they come back home, and that's they are the next generation that brings their child across. So it's a reciprocating cycle for us.
I'm
And
trying to communicate that here because we have canoe clubs, because that's pretty much the culture here. So I'm part of the Hanalei Canoe Club. We have the largest kids program, probably one of them in the whole entire state, but in Kauai we do. So I say to them, these people drop their kids off, but they're not involved in anything. And I go, this is crazy. You need to involve them. Now, I'm not saying they have to go out in the canoe, but in terms of water safety. So, for example, I went to a steering committee meeting, and on Dr. Semstrat's encouragement, which I played one of his pieces, was for every parent who is by water, they should be taking CPR, breaths, and compressions, not just compressions. Okay? Because that's what they were doing. Oh, Margaret, we'll do CPR, but we'll get the fire department over here and we'll just do compressions. I said, no, you have to do breaths plus compressions. And since you're going to be doing it for the kids, you need to have the parents involved. And they go, well, we can't make them. I said, you just ex educate them to why it's important as a parent. You can't make them, but that's a really big piece. And they're still sitting on it. When we have probably 100 kids and then all their parents, and as you're saying, that brings the more the
you're
community.
sitting on a gold mine of about 400 people, aren't you?
Thank
Waiting to
you.
do something, definitely do a great thing. Amazing.
Maybe I'll have to record you and play you for the and I also told them that I was told that canoe clubs are the worst offenders of water safety. Wearing life jackets here in Hawaii, we don't feel we need to do that. But in defense, there's more conversation around water safety, more understanding that that we need to be safer, and there's more conversation about the fact that we need to have CPR, breaths plus compressions. But I like this pushy, pushy, blowy, blowy. Sparky, Sparky. Is the AED the Sparky, Sparky?
Yeah.
There's always back to that, what's in it for me? So we introduced AEDs to the Coast Guard here in the UK. This was about 6, 7 years ago now. And originally there was a lot of resistance. Oh no, we don't see enough. And actually the UK Coast Guard deals with about 20,000 incidents per year on average. And of those, we probably deal with another, I think it's about 100 to 150 cardiac arrests. And our actual coastal rescue teams, where we were delivering the AEDs to, it wasn't that many. And the biggest sell was the chief coast guard at the time said to me, well, who's this going to benefit? And I turned around to him and said, well, you're more likely to use the AED on one of your own staff because they all fall into that high risk category. And it will be rare we'll use it on a water-based incident, but we will use it probably on one of our own members of staff. Well, so what do you mean? He said, well, the risk of cardiac disease goes up as you get older. In fact, the peak age group is between 50 and 60.
Oh,
I said,
thanks.
how old are you, by the way, anyway? I'm 59. When can we get them? And that was it. We spent £500,000 the following week, and we got them all in because there was a recognition that whilst the children, there's not going to be a problem with electrical activity being an issue needing an AED, those parents dropping them off, it's very likely it's one of those is going to have a problem. Or it's your husband or your wife or your next door neighbour. And that's a skill you can take on. The other seller, a colleague of mine, did this in another area. And he said, the best way we got parents to turn up is we said, right, turn up. And here's the deal. The Wi-Fi is free. The coffee tastes great. But you give me 20 minutes of your time.
Oh,
The
okay.
bright ones, they dropped the kids off. They had 20 minutes of education. And for the next hour and 20 of the swim lessons or the activity, they got to sit there on the laptops and do their work with decent coffee. So they didn't go anywhere. And like you say, slowly they're like, actually, that's more interesting. So I'm going to go over there and I'm going to put the laptop down. And yeah, it's about people. And it's reminding them a lot of the skills. And that's one of the nice things about the drowning prevention world and training lifeguards is you're not training them to be a lifeguard tomorrow. You're training them to be a member of a community who can do this any time of the day or night. Being a lifeguard, it's a bit like being a priest or a doctor. Once you've got it, it never goes away. That's it. Once you've been taught pushy, pushy, blowy once, you can usually remember it. And I've done some medical legal cases where a guy actually came up to me afterwards and said, oh, I just want to say thanks. And I said, why? I said, well, this person did die, but I pretty much did what you told me to do 20 years ago. I was like, did I? He went, yep, you were on the video. It was you. That's what I did. I said, I was 20 years out of date, but I still did pushy, pushy, blowy, blowy. And the individual survived to get to hospital. And that's the key bit is, you're not training them in drowning prevention. You're not training them in water safety. You're giving them a life skill. And it's a life skill that never goes away. And again, that's the other key thing to sell when they're talking about taking it into schools is this is a life skill. It's a bit like, don't put your fingers in a plug socket because you'll electrocute yourself. Don't go play in rip current. And by the way, this is what rip current looks like. All those little things, they're life skills. They're not just one-off events. Sorry, I got off
And
my
when you do
soapbox.
it's a gift, isn't it?
Yeah.
We often, but for a family member to know that their person's poorly, and you've done that, and you've done the best of your ability, it's a gift of closure as well. So if they've succeeded, great. And they're very rare events, and going by a lottery ticket, well done, because they are rare events, and they're rare enough to survive. But at least somebody, within the community there, stopped and did something. So and they did it well. So that's, I always look at it as a gift. You get told a life skill. It's a gift from one person to the next lifesaver that can use that gift to either train more people or they do it for real. Either way, it's a gift.
Yeah, it's a gift here to have the lifeguards here, and a lot of people don't understand that. Somebody just told me yesterday, she said, I never thought of having water safety in my toolkit as a parent, but I know that it's very important. So I don't think most people think about that. There's layers of protection for having car seats and the stove and all those kinds of things, fires, but we're not doing anything in water safety like we should, as you have said. It should
And I
be.
think the thing as well, Margaret, is that water generally is in a remote location, either a beach or a river. So keeping somebody doing the basics very well may just keep them ready to come out. They are rare events, but this isn't an urban environment where there's a truck nearby with red lights flashing and that lot. This is not going to happen like this, and it's not going to be in a moor where first aiders are on scene. This is in a remote location, and this is the argument of getting parents involved. So kids learn it, parents learn it, school kids learn it, teachers learn it. In those remote locations, somebody can give that gift a chance, for somebody's life. So that's in my mind,
And the science to back that up is that we know that if somebody does have a drowning event and they stop breathing and they're at the point of going into cardiac arrest, the sooner you deliver effective ventilations and chest compressions, the more likely they are to survive. And Laquan's original work back in the late 90s, early 2000s pointed out if you can give ventilations and chest compressions before the actual heart stops, which is in those first sort of 2 to 5 minutes, you have a 96, 97% chance of survival with good neurological outcome. So again, how do you sell that to the parents? You say, well, listen, team, nearest emergency medical response, if you're in the UK, has to be within 8 minutes. If you're rural, a bit longer. Most likely time to have a problem? In the bath, in the swimming pool, in the yard, when you're on a day out. And for every minute that you're not doing effective ventilations, chest compressions, you're risking your child having disability, brain injury, or worst case scenario, death. Give it 15, 20 minutes, you might as well not bother. And suddenly, when you start selling those numbers to people, they're like, okay, what can I do about that? And you go, no, oh, it's dead easy. Pushy, pushy, blowy, blowy. Come and join the lifeguards. Come see how it's done.
I can see T-shirts coming out now, Margaret. I can see T-shirts, Hawaiian T-shirts, saying "Pumpy, pumpy, blowy, blowy, sparky, sparky." You're in.
I think that's a great t-shirt. Every kid could have one of those. I'm actually going to work on that, but I could talk forever. So I think it's July 25th is World Drowning Prevention or Water Safety. How do you
World
say?
Drowning Prevention Day.
Okay. So last year we got involved with Mike Tipton and we did Float to Live. I got lifeguards and junior lifeguards to float. I got my canoe club to float and I realized some of them didn't know how to float. It was So, are you involved in that effort again? Are you?
Yeah, we've got we're using a mnemonic, STAR, float like a star, in our organization. So STAR's a mnemonic saying stay calm, tilt your head and ears back into the water. A
Okay.
is use your arms and legs to scull, and R to relax, and that's it. Float like a star.
Oh, that's very nice. Now, is this last year was Find Your Float?
Yeah, it's still going on this year. It's the same thing we're going to be saying nationally. Find your float with a little bit more stuff coming in, but yeah, we want to push the message out because it's starting to grow, and so what we've done at Surf Lifesaving is just added a little bit more so the kids get it a little easier. So that's where we're going.
Well, we want to be part of that again. So I was wondering if Georgina was doing anything about merchandise because I thought everybody here went, wow, Find Your Float. That's a great t-shirt or hat or something. I don't know. But I kind of like pushy, pushy, blowy, blowy, sparky, sparky. Because
We're
that.
going global, Paddy. We're going global.
There are two sides to a t-shirt. It's okay.
We can use that. What did you say, Dr. Morgan?
So there's two sides to a t-shirt. Find your float on the back and pushy, pushy, blow, blow in the front.
Oh, okay.
And
That's really
there's another one for you, Margaret, for a t-shirt. Instant lifeguard, just add water.
yeah. I think we better work on this. Maybe you could go back to the dinner table now after I've taken you for an hour and a half, of which you'll never let me go for that one, and come up with a design.
That could be scary. Okay,
There may be a glass or two of wine involved this evening, so maybe not tonight. So
well, thank you very
consumption.
much. I can't appreciate, I can't say enough about you both coming on because there's such good information you gave. And I will continue this conversation and I'm sure I'll have you both back on because what you have to say is so important. And we reach a huge audience internationally, but you know how it is. You have to keep saying these things over and over again. So I've kind of asked from things for you for some papers and then some slides from Patty. So I want to keep up on that. And Dr. Morgan, I also need a photo from you. And Adrian, I need another one if you want to give me another one, a new one.
So I'm finding something for you, yeah.
Okay. All
You're a
right.
good one. And just to sign off, I've just popped into the chat a couple of links to some papers. The final one is the Manchester Arena Inquiry, and it's worth reading from exactly what we were talking about. The gentleman did it, Sir Saunders. He did a really good inquiry for the first time in UK law. He did what he called monitored recommendations. So he put recommendations out and said, right, no offense, you always ignore me. So this time you're going to come back in 12 months and you're going to prove that you've done what I said you did. And one of the key things they identified is that in a major instance, it was a nasty event. It was a bombing in a music hall. Was the zero responder. That's the neighbor. It's the person who stood next to you when the bomb goes off. That they actually did a huge amount of work. So again, it's worth sliding that underneath the governor's eyes to say, look, in the UK, they recognize the value of the zero responder and the fact that actually, if you train them in the right things, they can be really powerful allies in your treatment and prevention of these incidents. On that note, I will
Thank
shut
you.
up and sign off.
That was wonderful. And I can't thank you enough. You do so much great work. And the fact that you came on the show is just, I can't thank you enough. It will help us. I know it will. So thank you again, both of you. And don't forget
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure to see you again as well. So thank you for inviting me and Paddy as well.
pushy, pushy, blowy, blowy, sparky, sparky.
Yours.
All right. Thank
Brilliant.
you, guys. I will cut
Thanks.
it off at that, but I can't thank you enough. What a great, it's just so impressive. And it really made the difference when people here heard from Mike Tipton and Adrian that starting to say, oh, wow, we really need to think about floating. You know, the swimming aspect's not, you know, as important as we need survival skills in the ocean and in the pool and in the river. So, all right. Have a glass of wine for me, Dr. Morgan.
And me
A
too.
non-alcoholic
All variety, obviously.
Oh, good. Okay, you better catch up.
Pleasure
You
meeting
take
you,
care,
Mark.
Margaret. Oh, yeah, it was really great. And tell Mike, you know, he's disappointed. We'll have to have you both all on again in a couple of months.
We're
Okay.
delighted.
All right.
Have a great day. God bless.
Thank you.
Cheers,
Bye.
buddy.
Bye.
Bye.